We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk with Eat This Day. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning?
No, he's at home resting today.
All right. So starting out with local and an endorsement.
Yeah, Bruce Harrell, the recent mayoral candidate and a city council member, came out this week and endorsed Ed Murray for mayor in this coming election. He rejected the opportunity to endorse Mike McGinn, as three other city council members have also done, and went for Murray instead. So, you know, that's four out of nine city council members. I think the others are Clark, Rasmussen, and Burgess, who was himself also a former mayoral candidate until he dropped out earlier this year. So that's kind of interesting because it's not typical for a lot of city council members to line up and endorse the challenger in a mayoral race. You know, typically you'll have a few of them come out on behalf of the current incumbent, and several that might stand back and say, well, I'm not making an endorsement in this race, or maybe they quietly endorse the incumbent, or one or two of them endorse the challenger. But in this case, it looks like Murray's trying to go for a majority of the city council, and he might be successful.
Well, and McGinn has a history of not getting along with city council.
Yes, he does.
So, that's...
And it was kind of interesting too, because at that same press conference where Harrell announced his endorsement, Murray sat next to him and really hit back at McGinn over his stance on being against the Department of Justice review of the Seattle Police Department, and mostly really hit McGinn on what he called his public safety issues, that like an increase in violent crime, mostly related to domestic violence. And, you know, during McGinn's recent tenure, the funds for the domestic violence assault unit were cut. So, yeah, you know, it was a very interesting press conference, particularly since Harrell sits on the public safety committee on the city council. That was Murray's opportunity to really hit at McGinn, in an area that I think really is his weakness, the fact that he stood shoulder to shoulder with the Seattle Police Department and resisted the community when the community said, you know, you have to do something about police violence.
All right. Moving on, a report out this week from Como.
Como did a report this week on Seattle's traffic signal system. And they were basically covering a presentation that was made to the city council about the Seattle traffic signal system that found that 70% of the system was trending towards failure. It's a 30-year-old control system that was installed in 1985 that handles all of the traffic signals in the city of Seattle, and that the city's maintenance, that the city Department of Transportation's maintenance of the traffic signal system is basically focused on replacing signals that fail when they fail, instead of doing some very basic preemptive maintenance work like retiming traffic signals, which you know, they need to be taken care of and retimed after a while. You know, every couple of years they need to have somebody come out, check them, make sure that they're functioning properly. Well, the city doesn't do that the way they should, really. Most signals in the city of Seattle don't get retimed, or when they do, it's about every 7 years at the most. So this report was very critical of how the Seattle Department of Transportation is taking care of that program. Of course, it didn't point out that it's really budgetary woes that are a big part of this, because there's not the money to replace the traffic signal system. That's a system that's 30 years old, and there's about a $6 million deficit in the budget for retiming and replacing signals. So, you know, you can do that if you've got the money. If you don't have the money, you can't do it. But of course, it also points to what are the city's priorities. I know we've talked about this quite a bit on the air, that a lot of the transportation priorities of the city are backwards. For example, running streetcars, for example, funding the Mercer Beautification Project instead of putting money towards basic maintenance like fixing up the traffic signal system, fixing up potholes, fixing up the roadways. The city has a bunch of bridges that need repair work to them or replacement. And, of course, it wouldn't hurt to put some money towards real transit that doesn't itself cause traffic congestion the same way, you know, mistimed traffic signals do.
And it's much cheaper, too, my understanding, to do these fixes, the potholes and the traffic timing. And it seems like every year or two, you got somebody coming out saying, oh, we're going to look at that, but
nobody ever really puts money towards it. Instead, you know, we get money put towards the projects where the developer friends of the current mayor have come in and made a big deal about how we want, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to go towards fixing up Mercer so it's a two-way street, you know, making the sidewalks wider, essentially a beautification project that does nothing to help the flow of traffic on Mercer, does nothing to decrease commute times across that corridor. In fact, is going to slow down commute times across the Mercer Street corridor. And that's just a waste of money. You know, when there are these other really basic maintenance problems that need taken care of.
Yeah, but if you're on the trolley, it'll still be a nice view.
It'll still be a nice ride. So, even if
you can always get out and walk.
Yeah, even if everybody else in a car that crosses your path is going to have to sit and wait for you to get through the light.
See them cursing you from the trolley. Uh-huh. All right. Health insurance.
Yeah, October 1st is when the Washington State Health Benefit Exchange will open. That's going to be our state health insurance exchange, as specified under the Obamacare plan that Washington State is setting up for uninsured people to be able to check on the exchange for the prices of policies offered through the exchange, insurance policies offered through the exchange, be able to sign up for a health insurance policy. And then your coverage would go into effect as of January 1st. Now, the phone hotline for the State Health Benefit Exchange, it went live this week on Tuesday. It was on the very first day of the new phone hotline to answer people's questions about the health exchange. They got over 900 calls in one day. That's about 60 people sitting in a room just answering, you know, one after another of phone calls, people asking, you know, what would be my plan choices, what are the costs, and what kind of subsidies. This is, I think, probably the most important question for people who are uninsured and can't and haven't been able to afford to buy their own private insurance. What kind of subsidies would they qualify for if they bought a policy through the state health exchange plan? And just for folks who are listening, you know, if you want to give them a call, I'm going to give you the phone number. Here, that phone number is 1-855-923-4633. You can ask them any of those questions, and they would be very happy to answer them. They also have a cost estimate calculator, an online feature that if you turn on your computer or you whip out your smartphone and go there, you could probably take a look at it and figure out yourself what your costs would be. That's at www.wahealthplanfinder.com. So far, about 7 different insurance companies have been approved to offer various plans in Washington State, and there are more companies who are lining up to be included eventually and get approval from the insurance commissioner and the board that's overseeing the health exchange. As I said, open enrollment starts October 1st. That's when you can go online and that's when the exchange itself literally opens. You can go online, look at the different plans, price them out, select one that you like, and sign up for your insurance. Insurance coverage would start January 1st.
Okay, so now people have actually had enough time to go find something to write on.
That number again is 1-855-923-4633. And again, if you want to go online and see the cost estimate calculator, it's at planfinder.com.
Okay, and maybe we can give that number out at the end of the show,
sure,
too, just
we
for
could do
people that,
that
are really can't find their pencil.
Right.
Okay. Well, I know my house is like that sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Actually, it's like that all the time. All right, and then a quick note that I actually meant to say at the top of the show. This morning's paper says that the $15 an hour is back on the ballot in SeaTac.
Yeah, the $15 an hour minimum wage.
Yes, minimum wage.
Initiative that was going to go, that sponsors have been trying to get on the ballot in SeaTac. A judge had thrown it out in having invalidated a whole bunch of signatures on that initiative. And the initiative proponents came back and submitted a whole bunch more new signatures. And apparently those new signatures have been validated now, and it's going to go on the ballot.
All right. So let's move on to national and, boy, this week's updates on our new surveillance. Well, actually, it's not new. The new and improved surveillance society.
Yeah, well, the NSA's most secret program. That's what we read about this week. Edward Snowden gave some more documents to The Guardian, and they shared them with The New York Times. So the whole nation here in America could read about them instead of us all having to go visit The Guardian's website to read it out of a British paper. Their most secret program is called Bull Run. It's an opportunistic decryption program. Apparently, the NSA has cracked most of the encryption in use in the U.S. today. In many cases, they've actually bullied U.S. companies into building a backdoor into their software and their hardware, and or significantly forced them to weaken their security encryption standards. Now, the papers that, well, maybe the documents that Snowden released mentioned specific companies, but the media didn't mention which specific companies have been involved in this. But the implication is that most high-tech firms have been forced to comply with this directive from the NSA. Some companies, of course, have said that they were coerced into handing over their entire encryption keys to the NSA. So if you think that sending your encrypted email means nobody's going to be able to read it, you are absolutely, absolutely wrong. If you think that storing your data in the cloud is as secure as your cloud service provider is telling you, you are absolutely wrong, because your cloud service provider has been forced to give their encryption keys to the NSA or to build in a backdoor that the NSA can then exploit.
Well, and if your cloud service provider is, let's say, Amazon, which is currently contracting with the CIA to do their cloud services, then
you're
really out of luck.
Yeah. Now, I just want to remind folks of the history of this. Internet encryption really became a big deal in the 1990s when some of the early encryption programs were standards were invented. In the 1990s, the Clinton administration, seeing that internet communications were going to become something that they couldn't easily read and easily crack, decided that they were going to try to introduce the Clipper chip in response to that. I know I see Mike laughing over there. Yeah, you remember the Clipper chip the same way I do, and how everybody was universally against it. I mean, there was just this huge outcry saying this is going to violate the Fourth Amendment, you know, and it's going to destroy the U.S. tech industry if we can't ensure to our customers that their data is going to be private. Who's going to buy anything from U.S. companies? And so the Clinton administration was forced to back down. In 1996, the Clipper chip died. However, what these documents tell us is that even though the Clinton administration didn't introduce the Clipper chip, the NSA found other ways to get around that and went ahead and did essentially the same thing anyway. So, and I just want to point out, too, that the decryption involved in the Bull Run program isn't just targeted decryption. I mean, this is the sort of thing that you're going to hear from the Obama administration. Oh, we only decrypt. We only look at communications from targeted individuals, and we only target specific messages, blah, blah, blah. That is not what the Bull Run program does. It does not do targeted decryption. It does opportunistic decryption, which, as described by the New York Times, is, quote, it decodes in real time all of the information flying over the world's fiber optic cables and through its internet hubs, only afterwards searching the decrypted material for valuable intelligence, end quote. And as we know now from the documents that were released earlier by Snowden and that have been discussed in the media, that the NSA keeps that data for at least 5 years. And all those decrypted messages can be easily searched in one big database, can be easily searched by NSA analysts, you know, just typing in a few search words. Now, the U.S., even though this is probably the most secret program of the NSA, the U.S. has shared this tech with four other countries around the world. Those countries are Britain, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. And you just looking at that list, I just thought, oh, man, those are our English-speaking white majority allies. I mean, you can't get a whole lot more racist than that, can you? Now, also, aside from the violation of the Fourth Amendment, you know, you really have to think about this in terms of security. Building backdoors into products, whether they're software products or hardware products, really makes them more easily exploitable, not just by the government, but by anybody. You know, don't forget that Edward Snowden was a contractor. He worked for a private company that worked for the U.S. government, that works still for the U.S. government. And, you know, if a private company can have an employee like Snowden who can get in and get data from the NSA that he did not have the clearance to see, I mean, data on the Bull Run program, he was not cleared to see that kind of information, and yet he still got his hands on it. Just think about the number of hackers out there in the wild, so to speak, who, you know that there are exploits built into software and hardware that's made by U.S. companies that are going to be out there figuring out a way to get in there and look at your data.
Now, my understanding, though, for Snowden, he didn't hack to get hacked.
He didn't have to hack, no.
Because he had administrator privileges. He was one of a thousand people that had privileges.
It was a backdoor.
So he could get anything he wanted.
Yeah, that's essentially a backdoor or an exploitable process built into the system that the NSA uses. You know, I mean, that's the problem with lowering the standards of encryption and lowering the security standards for all U.S. products is that it builds in this massive vulnerability to the entire system. In addition, it's going to do exactly what the high-tech industry feared with the Clipper chip. There are going to be a lot of foreign governments and a lot of foreign customers who look at U.S. products and say, I'm not buying that computer. I'm not buying that software because, you know, the NSA, anybody could look at my stuff. Anybody who knows anything about encryption technology will have the ability or have the opportunity to figure this out. And what's really disturbing is that the NSA often bypasses the whole encryption thing altogether. They can gain access to your desktops, your laptops, even your smartphones, and they see messages before you encrypt it or after it's been decrypted through its normal route. That's a vulnerability that's been built into U.S. hardware and the software that runs the basics of your hardware system. Also, I want to point out too that there are some companies that have been driven out of the U.S. market because they won't knuckle under and hand over their encryption keys. Lavabit, if folks remember, Lavabit was an email encryption company. They basically said, you know, we can't function in this environment, and sent a public letter to all their customers saying, you know, because of requirements from the U.S. government, we can't ensure the security of your email communications. Silent Circle is another company that was forced to shut down its email service because it wouldn't give its encryption keys to the NSA. So, you know, this is a very serious issue, and it's really explosive that this stuff is being released now, and we're actually hearing about it.
It just seems to keep getting worse.
It does.
All right, but that wasn't the only surveillance news this week.
That wasn't the only surveillance news, no. Once you open the door and start talking about it, all kinds of things come to light. In this case, the DEA, it turns out, also has its own big secret program, and AT&T is a major partner in it. It turns out AT&T keeps your phone calls. I didn't know this. AT&T keeps your phone call data pretty much forever. They have a huge database that they have kept since 1987 that has all of your phone call information and, more disturbingly, the actual location of where you are when you make each phone call. It then gives law enforcement access to this database, particularly the DEA and local police departments. This big database and this law enforcement access to it is called the Hemisphere Project. The government apparently pays AT&T to put its employees into anti-drug units around the country, where they help the DEA agents and local police to get access to their phone data. Now, this Hemisphere Project, this huge database, it captures every call that passes through an AT&T switch, not just calls made by AT&T customers. So you could be, for example, a Verizon customer. You could make a phone call, and if your phone call passes through a switch that's an AT&T switch, as many, 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 many calls do, then it'll get captured in this big database. There are about 4 billion call records that enter the database every day. Now, unlike the NSA database, AT&T's database includes, like I said, the location data on every call and where it was made from. And it also keeps the calls for a much, much longer period of time. For a lot of folks, 1987 is literally forever, because there are a lot of people out there using cell phones who were born after that date. Hard to believe, but it's true. Now, it's so secret, the Hemisphere Project is so secret, that no news agency has ever reported on it before, and it has never been discussed in any congressional hearing. So there's literally no government oversight of this partnership project between the DEA and AT&T and local police departments. Now, the New York Times only learned of it from a Washington State activist who was part of a group of activists in the Olympia area who have been doing an FOIA, FOIA requests, to get information from local West Coast police agencies about spying on domestic activists, because anti-war groups in the Olympia area had been spied on by their local police department and by local military personnel as well, particularly when they were organizing demonstrations to block shipments of weapons to the Middle East to try to stop weapons and personnel going over to the Middle East, to Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, this is kind of interesting too, because the Hemisphere Project only came to light in a PowerPoint slideshow that was released to these activists, and they turned around and gave it to the New York Times. The New York Times looked at it and said, "Oh my God," and finally printed an article about it. Now, When it comes to the Hemisphere Project, any barriers, this is the most disturbing thing about this, is that any barriers to what the DEA or local cops can actually see of your phone records are pretty much non-existent. It does require a subpoena for them to look at the database. However, it's not a subpoena issued by a judge or jury or any kind of court. It's what's called an administrative subpoena. That means it's a subpoena issued by a federal agency, in this case, the DEA. So literally, the DEA can issue its own subpoenas, go to AT&T and say, "Hey, we want to look at your database. Let us see it." And AT&T says, "Oh yeah, here you go. Look all you want. Take whatever you want." So in other words, the government asks and AT&T gives. And moreover, more importantly, is that it's taxpayer money that's funding the Hemisphere Project. AT&T doesn't pay for this. It's your money that pays for this. So once again, you're paying more than once. You pay for telephone access. Maybe you pay for the phone as well. And then you pay to have the DEA go in and search your records, and local police agencies as well, to be able to go in and search your phone records whenever they want to.
On to international and developments in Japan at Fukushima.
Yeah, Fukushima has been in the news in Japan lately. It should be more of an international news story, because this week the Japanese government took over the cleanup and containment of the damaged nuclear plants at Fukushima, because TEPCO has been mismanaging not just the cleanup because really the cleanup has not even really started, but the actual containment of the plant. Contaminated soil has been found beneath several of the water tanks that are storing water from cooling the plant, but also storing water that's been leaking into the basement of these damaged nuclear reactors. It turns out that the Fukushima Daiichi plant was built not just on a fault line or near a very big fault line, but it also is built in a part of the country where water runoff is a big problem. So there's a huge amount of groundwater that runs off the nearby mountains right through that site. And it's been leaking into the basement of these plants, becoming contaminated, and then it has to be pumped out and stored in these big water tanks. Well, the problem is these big water tanks are not being built to be durable. TEPCO, you know, because they need them built quickly or because they don't want to spend a lot of money, they've been building these water tanks with rubber seals on them, not with welded seals. And so these tanks are now leaking. Now, and of course, on this very large site, everyone thought that there would be plenty of room to hold water tanks. Well, the site is getting close to filling up with water tanks now, and there's no place to put more of them. So someone's got to step in and figure out what to do about this. TEPCO had assured us that they would have a system to clean the water and be able to recycle it. Well, that is not panned out. And now they're talking about putting up a bunch of big generators on the site, freezing the ground around the site to try to prevent groundwater from flowing into the basement of the plants and thereby slowing the amount of contaminated water that they have to deal with. Well, the problem with that, anybody who knows that if you try to put up a barrier to groundwater, it's got to go somewhere. Typically, if you put a big barrier of groundwater below ground, what happens to the water? The water flows along the surface. So that in itself could be a disaster in the making. The problem is, of course, the Japanese government, the panel that's overseeing the cleanup is combined mostly of folks who are themselves from the nuclear industry. So really the international community has got to step in and start saying, look, we've got to manage this as if it were a major international disaster, not just a national problem.
Which it is a major.
Which it really is. Disaster. It is a major international disaster because contaminated water is leaking into the Pacific Ocean. It's a continuous leak and it's not going away anytime soon.
Leaves all of about 1 minute to try and touch on Syria.
On Syria, yeah, there's so much on Syria this week. But I just want to kind of talk about a little bit about how the Obama administration has been assuring us it's going to be limited strikes on Syria. It's only going to be Tomahawk cruise missiles. While at the same time, they've been sending aircraft carriers to the eastern Mediterranean. They've been talking to our only ally, France, in this project, saying yes, we can muster airplanes to do air strikes on Syria. And this week, Secretary of State Kerry went before the Senate committee that was voting on authorizing the strikes, and he tried to get them to not include a limit on sending ground troops into Syria. So really what we're seeing here is a pattern where the Obama administration is saying one thing and gearing up for a war. For a real war in Syria, so this might be familiar to people who have been watching our activities in the Middle East for the last 12 to 13 years. That it's not going to be just some cruise missile strikes. Also, there have been a lot of other stories on Syria, efforts to demonize the Assad regime, continuing efforts to link the chemical weapons attack to Assad himself, which I think is going to be impossible to do. But also, Human Rights Watch condemned the Syrian government for using cluster bombs, conveniently forgetting that cluster bombs are still in the U.S. arsenal and that we use them in Iraq and Afghanistan. Also, nobody is mentioning that the U.S. Has chemical weapons in its arsenal, that we have deployed white phosphorus in Iraq and Afghanistan, which by all definitions is a chemical weapon. And hence, you know, we shouldn't be surprised when other Middle Eastern governments kind of scratch their heads and say, You what? You want to condemn him for using chemical weapons? Don't you use chemical weapons? I mean, the hypocrisy is just amazing. So we're going to move on to events. Just kind of round it up. The main event this week is that on noon today at Westlake Center, there's going to be an emergency rally against a strike on Syria. Also tomorrow, Sunday at 7 p.m., Jim McDermott's going to be at University United Methodist Church to talk about Syria. That's at 1413 Northeast 43rd in the U District.